May it please the Court. My name is Matt Bartkowski. I represent the plaintiffs in this matter. It's my understanding that the Court has limited this argument to three specific issues. I'll start with regarding the issue of the exclusion of the defendant's prescription medication during the course of the trial. This case involved a very strange accident that occurred at Summit Bridge. We had a car that stopped at the base of the bridge, and a motorcycle struck the rear end of that vehicle. There's construction in that area. This isn't something that you would normally expect to see, the type of accident. One of the biggest issues at trial was the level of the anxiety of the defendant in this case. The important part of that was is in her discovery deposition as well as at trial, the defendant changed her story from what she had told the police officer initially. At trial, she gave a description of the accident with her description of her anxiety level was significantly decreased. She used terms such as nervousness, that she slowed down to 5 to 10 miles an hour, that she was pulling off the side of the road, where she was going 5 to 10 miles an hour. This was in contrast to what the police officer testified, as well as what was contained in his report. She told the police officer she had fear of bridges, for which she takes prescription medication, that she was getting upset, that she called her ex-husband to calm her down. She got to the base of the bridge, and she abruptly stopped her vehicle. She also indicated that she had panicked, that she had an anxiety attack. So according to what she told the police officer, her anxiety level was significant in how this accident occurred. Prior to the trial, the trial judge excluded any references to medication at trial whatsoever. The police officer was instructed he couldn't discuss medications at all. If you take away what the police officer, take away that aspect of the medications, the police officer's testimony was significantly cut down. It also made the defendant's testimony more credible. And also lessened the credibility of the police officer. The credibility of the police officer versus the defendant was probably the secondary biggest issue in this case.
Let me interrupt you. Sure. Why is it that the absence of evidence of medications impacted the police officer's credibility?
Well, it did because the statement then that the police officer gave was kind of a watered-down version of what the defendant actually gave him. His testimony was such saying that she's very upset, she's excited, and then for him to say, well, she has a fear of bridges, she slowed down and she abruptly stopped her vehicle. It took some of the impact of the police officer's statement away, but it also made him less credible when the defense saying, hey, wait a minute, the police officer didn't do an appropriate investigation in this case. He didn't do everything that he was supposed to, when in fact, if he was allowed to testify, that the defendant told him that she took prescription medication, it'd be consistent with the way the accident occurred, also would substantiate what he did in the investigation that he actually performed in this accident. So it would have made him look more credible as well.
Well, are you trying to say that if what actually happened is that the police officer gets there and the defendant says, I've got this horrible fear of bridges, I take medication for it and so on, that was all he had to do in terms of investigating the accident?
No, I don't think that that's all he had to do. I think he was required to do a whole lot more. But I think that in combination with what else, the other areas that he had to take as part of his investigation, the fact of him being able to include that she told me she took prescription medication would substantiate that how upset she was, that she had an anxiety attack, that she abruptly stopped her vehicle versus just saying, well, I got a little nervous and I pulled off the side of the road. So it's our position that the medication was significant. I know the court addressed previously at the last hearing about the waiver of the doctor-patient provision. Even if that's the case and even if the court rules that the defendant didn't waive her physician-patient privilege, the police officer still should have been able to testify as to the statement that the defendant made regarding the use of prescription medication. It was still a party admission. It was, again, one of the biggest issues in this case. Going on to the issue regarding my client's use of his helmet, at the time of the accident, my client wasn't using a helmet when he was riding his motorcycle. The legislature has enacted, first, the with regard to the safety belt issue, the section of 4802 requires that the persons driving in the state of Delaware have to utilize the safety belt. But the legislature also put a provision in there that the non-use of that seat belt is not admissible for comparative negligence, contributory negligence, and is not admissible in evidence in any civil litigation. The legislature also has a statute regarding helmet use, and that statute requires that a helmet is required for to be in possession of the operator, but the only persons that's required to wear a helmet is somebody who's under 19 years of age. So if you're over 18 years old, you do not have to wear a helmet in the state of Delaware. It was up to the legislature to put in place any penalty that could be prescribed because of someone not using a helmet. If the legislature believed that it was admissible to introduce evidence of someone not using a helmet, if it was able to make a determination of, again, negligence, contributory or comparative negligence, or even the mitigation of damages, the legislator could have put a provision in there that stated, okay, well, someone's not required to wear a helmet in the state of Delaware. If they don't use one, then they are subject to
these potential. What was the trial judge's analysis on that, and how did the trial judge err?
Well, I think the trial judge, my understanding, basically said a jury should be entitled to hear that information about the non-use of a helmet. That there was initially a discussions of whether that was an assumption of risk for non-use of the helmet or whether it went into mitigation of damages, which the jury instruction eventually went into. The judge erred by allowing the jury to hear any aspect or any evidence whatsoever that my client wasn't wearing a helmet at the time of the accident.
That's the conclusion, but what is the analysis? What kind of rationale did the trial judge use to come to that conclusion?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'm not really positive as to what the court said, other than that she believed that the jury should hear evidence of the non-use of a helmet.
Without saying why?
Not that I recall, Your Honor. The only thing I know that she made a comment about that it would be foolish not to use a helmet, and the jury should be able to hear evidence that the plaintiff wasn't wearing a helmet.
To follow up on the Chief Justice's questions, assume that there were no statute regulating the use of helmets, motorcycle helmets. What would be the outcome of what actually took place in the courtroom, that is, regarding the admissibility of non-use of the helmet?
I think if you look at the common law before the Seatbelt Act was set forth, when seatbelt, there was no provision indicating that seatbelts weren't required in the state of Delaware, such evidence of use of a seatbelt was not admissible for comparative negligence, contributory negligence, mitigation of damages, with the exception, there was my understanding from one case about where there was a crashworthiness claim and there was enhancement of injuries claim, and that the...
You're saying that it would not be admissible?
It would not be admissible.
Under the common law?
Correct.
Even for damage mitigation purposes?
Even for mitigation of damages.
How about under the rules of evidence? Is there any guidance to be found in the rules of evidence?
I didn't find anything, Your Honor, in terms of anything that would guide in terms of the use of helmets. There have other states have looked at this issue before.
Was there any proffer made about the relationship between the stupidity of having a helmet on your motorcycle but not actually wearing it and the injuries that occurred?
None, Your Honor. No.
Anyone prepared to testify that but for the absence of the helmet, the injuries would not have been severe?
The only testimony I knew, there was cross-examination of our physician regarding the helmet, and it was only generic. It didn't go specifically to my client. There was no expert that came in and said, if Mr. McKinley was wearing a helmet, he would not have incurred this specific injury.
You understand where I'm going with that. I'm trying to find some kind of evidentiary proffer, some factual basis for the trial judge to conclude that the jury should hear that he wasn't wearing a helmet. The immediate question that comes to my mind is, why should the jury hear that? It's relevant to what? And on what factual basis, from what factual basis do you conclude the jury should hear it?
I'm not aware of the judge making any determination or any proffer that was made for why the jury should, in fact, hear evidence of non-use of a helmet, other than, I think a jury should hear this. That was the only thing that I understood from the.
So you're saying that as far as the record discloses, the only rationale for that ruling was the intuition of the judge?
Yes, Your Honor, and I might be missing something within what the rulings were, but that was my take on it from what the judge said.
Doesn't that at least imply that the judge thought it was relevant under Rule 401?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe she felt that it was relevant under 401.
But the question is, relevant to what?
I think that's the issue. It's relevant to what? Is it relevant to an issue of damages? Is it relevant to an issue of whether my client was at fault for the accident because he didn't wear a helmet?
Does the helmet statute figure into the analysis one way or the other?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any guidance from the legislature in the helmet statute as to whether or not the use of a helmet should be admissible or inadmissible.
So are you saying that if there had been a proffer of the kind that Chief Justice described, the response would be that under the common law, this type of evidence was not admissible for any purpose?
Correct. Correct.
But there was no proffer and there was no argument countering it?
No. The only argument was, and my argument was, is that there needed to be the defense needed to have a medical expert who was going to testify. Even if it was admissible, then it would be only for the purpose of mitigation of damages, and then you would have to have a medical expert who would have to come in and say specifically that my client would have sustained either less of an injury, would not have been injured at all, if he was wearing a motorcycle helmet. And that was never, there was not such an expert that was produced.
I take it your client did suffer head injuries?
Yes, he did. I think the next step goes on to the instruction that the judge gave. And it's, even though the instruction was couched in terms of damages, the jury instruction that was actually provided told the jury that basically if they found that my client assumed the risk without having a helmet, then he could be penalized because of that. And it just said at the very end it can go towards damages. But there was no testimony to indicate that there would have been any mitigation of damages. But I think it was improper to even say that any kind of non-use of my client with a helmet with an assumption of risk would have been permissible.
You're going to tell us why, I hope.
Sure. Because if you're telling the jury that if you find that the plaintiff has assumed the risk because he didn't wear a helmet, you're basically telling them you can punish him for this specific conduct that he had. So you're telling, whereas the legislature has indicated that there is no punishment for not wearing a helmet. So basically you're saying, okay, I did something that was legal, but yet I'm punished because I did something that was legal. My client didn't.
Well, there's a difference between negligence per se and negligence.
Correct.
And isn't that what you're talking about? Are you saying in order for a jury to reasonably conclude that a person riding a motorcycle without a helmet is negligent. They can't be found negligent unless they've been found negligent per se, because the statute says they must wear a helmet.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the argument you're making?
Yeah, essentially, Your Honor, I am. But I think the other part of this is the instruction itself just said that the jury can take that into consideration when considering my client's damages. It doesn't say that the jury has to find anything specific, that the defendant has to prove that my client sustained a lesser injury.
You objected to this instruction, correct?
Yes.
What did the trial judge rely on as precedent for this instruction?
That I'm not aware of, Your Honor. What happened was, is there originally was...
Well, did the trial judge cite any precedent or not?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. This was a...
Well, you tried the case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, if she did or he did, you would be aware of it.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't... And if I could maybe explain, it might be kind of explain the reason I'm not sure exactly.
That's why you're here.
Yeah. Because originally was a pure... The originally defense wanted a pure assumption of risk for non-use of a helmet in this case. I objected to it. There were discussions about it. The court had indicated that she still felt that there could be some type of instruction given, but given the fact that it would be a secondary assumption of risk regarding non-use of a helmet versus a primary assumption of risk, it led into this discussion about what we should do with it. Counsel and I discussed it. I still preserve my objection to it. But we talked about where would the appropriate place be if, in fact, it was admissible and it would go towards damages versus anything else. Even when we had agreed upon that, the court in the prayer conference had still indicated that there was case law in which she believed would be where there still would be able to be a instruction on assumption of the risk that would be permitted, not just in terms of damages.
And to be distinguished from an instruction sometimes called a failure to mitigate damages.
Correct.
Well, how does not wearing the helmet bear on negligence in causing or not causing the accident? Or
well,
how is not wearing a helmet a proximate cause of the accident?
Well, it is. The accident would have happened no matter whether my client was or wasn't wearing a helmet at the time of the accident. And that's why the...
Is it your position that the instruction as given would confuse the jury on whether it goes to proximate cause or whether it goes to mitigation of damages?
I think it would for both of those. I think the jury looking at then hearing what the instruction was, I think it would go to both proximate cause and mitigation of damages, especially towards mitigation of damages, especially there was no instruction as to how do you mitigate the damages? What's it based upon? Who has the burden of proof to show that? Basically, they're telling the jury, hey, you can take this into consideration when you award damages. What does that mean? Especially in light of the fact that there is no expert who would come in and say, okay, this is what the damages would be if there was, you know, was if my client was wearing a helmet versus what he when he wasn't wearing a helmet. That's all I have at this time. If the court has any questions.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I would, please. Right.
Please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As to the first issue dealing with the use of medication at trial, this was discussed somewhat, or the court's decision that the police officer could not talk about any statements my client made to the police officer about medication at trial. We discussed this at the last argument, and I've given more thought to that since we had the last argument. Essentially, everything came in that was said to the police officer, with the exception of the fact that he asked her if she was taking any prescription medications, and she told him, according to him, that she took prescription medications for fear of bridges. all the other anxiety-related testimony came out. So this was only a very small portion of the police officer's testimony that would have been included. The concern that we had was whether or not this was, first of all, relevant under Rule 401, and it really was not relevant to determine whether or not she had caused this accident. The question is, was she anxious, and did she stop suddenly or pull off to the side of the road? Jury, there's no doubt she was anxious, and the jury knew that. Evidence about whether she was taking medication would not make it more likely that she stopped suddenly or more likely that she pulled off. A person could do either of those things if a person was even taking medication for that.
Would a jury be more likely to believe that she had stopped abruptly if they knew that her level of anxiety had to be treated with medication than they would believe that she slowed and came to a stop and or pulled off the side of the road?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Well, but is there... Well, none of us know what a particular jury is going to do on a particular day. That's one of the joys of practice, isn't it? But is it more likely than not that a reasonable juror would be persuaded by that? Is there some relevance to that, in other words?
There could be some relevance to it, Your Honor, which then takes us to Rule 403 and whether it should be excluded for that reason. And my concern about it is that it would then cause the jury to speculate about her medication use. That is, should she be taking medication? Should she not be taking medication? She never put her medical condition at issue in this case. She never said her conduct on the day of this accident should be excused because of the fact that she has a fear of bridges. She admitted she was anxious and nervous when she got to the scene of this accident. If the plaintiff was going to pursue that, then an expert would have to come in and testify about the relevance and about whether she should be taking medication or shouldn't be taking medication on the day.
So again, there was no proffer that said the reason I'm asking these questions is because I will present evidence that shows if she's on this type of medication at this type of dosage, it means she has a high level of anxiety when she confronts bridges. No one was prepared to enter that kind of information.
No such evidence would come out, and the jury would then be speculating.
Okay.
And it's sort of like, the other thing is she didn't volunteer this. It wasn't an admission. She was responding to his questions to her. And I think Justice Holland asked a question at the last argument about concern about the fact that we don't want to limit police officers from testifying about things that are said at the scene of an accident. And that struck me as I thought about it more as something along the lines of the way we take depositions. We get a lot of information in a deposition that may not be admissible at trial. The police officer gets a lot of information at the scene that may not be admissible at trial. That's why the trial court is the gatekeeper as to whether something should be admissible. So,
well,
yes, Your Honor.
I'm having a little trouble with the basic concept here because it seems kind of intuitively that in evaluating what a person did in a particular situation and hearing that this person has anxiety or fears or whatever, it would be probative to know that those fears and anxieties rise to the level of requiring medication. Even if you don't know what the medication is, it is an indicator, is it not, of the level of one of the person's emotional condition?
It could be, Your Honor. It's at the same time highly prejudicial to the defendant, and it essentially allows the plaintiff to put the defendant's medical condition at issue when the defendant did not do that to defend the case. Then the only way the defendant can defend is to bring in a doctor to talk about the defendant's use or non-use of medication. She wasn't using any on the day of this accident. And that gets into issues that are highly prejudicial against my client, particularly when the plaintiff had not had any intent to introduce any evidence that she should have been taking medication or, in fact, that anyone should take medication for use of driving over a bridge. I mean, the question is, should a doctor prescribed Valium to somebody driving over a bridge? Should somebody be driving under the influence of Valium? Those
okay.
are very significant issues.
Okay, and obviously, you know, there's a continuum here. And if you start with police officer, did you ask the the person whether he or she was taking any drugs, and just a basic run-through of, yes, and I was told that she has prescription drugs for to deal with her anxiety. And it seems to me that if anybody wanted to, if the defendant wanted to take that any further, they could, because the door's been opened. But there's no real need to. It is a relevant fact. It may not say that much, since we don't know what drugs. It may say a lot if it turns out she wasn't on any medication, but she has a prescription for this kind of anxiety. It seems pretty relevant.
Your Honor, my client's position is that it would cause the jury to speculate. It would mislead the jury with no expert available to testify about the significance. There's no standard that says somebody should take medication to go over a bridge. There's no indication that any doctor would or did prescribe medication for a person going over the bridge. The plaintiff wasn't prepared to prove that. So I would say under 403 it's not relevant. One other issue in looking at the rules again, Rule 103 says that an error predicating on a ruling admitting or excluding evidence should only address a substantial right of a party. And I would submit that this is not something that rises to the level of a substantial right of the plaintiff. This is a small part.
Well, was anxiety of the driver a central issue in the case?
It was a central issue, and the jury heard a lot about it, and the plaintiff was able to make a lot out of that in front of the jury. And my client admitted she was very anxious. She admitted to that in front of the jury. So they knew that she either stopped abruptly or was slowing and could have done either because of her level of anxiety.
You agree this was not cumulative? It was different. It's just subject to exclusion, in your view.
I don't know whether I would say it was cumulative. I think it was highly prejudicial.
Well, doesn't this bring us back to the Chief Justice's question about wasn't it relevant, or to use Justice Berger's word in her question, probative for the jury to know she just was not another anxious person who was concerned about going over bridges. She was a person who was so anxious that she took medication to deal with it.
Your Honor, we then have to get into the question then is, was she truly given a prescription for anxiety? I would then have to, I guess, call a doctor to disprove that when the plaintiff wasn't prepared to prove that it's something that was necessary. And therefore is very prejudicial to the defendant.
We're talking here about admitting the police officer's statement. Whenever the police do an investigation, they say, did you consume any alcohol? Are you taking any medication? They'd like to know what could be influencing your driving. The police officer was going to testify. She told me she was taking medication, and she was taking it because of her anxiety for crossing bridges. We normally let police officers talk about party admissions at the scene of an accident. Why shouldn't that have not been admissible? And she could deal with it. She could say, I never said that, but why wouldn't it come in as evidence?
I think there's a difference between a person volunteering something to an officer at the scene and the police officer asking somebody a question that the person is required to answer.
Well, if that was the rule, then if someone was stopped for driving under the influence and said, yes, I had three beers, that would be inadmissible because they were answering the officer's question and they didn't volunteer it.
Sometimes, Your Honor, that kind of information is suppressed. Sometimes there are cases, in criminal cases, where things that are said to the officer are suppressed. If an officer looked at a party and said, you know, you seem very agitated, why are you agitated? And the person said, well, I've had six DUIs before, so I'm really nervous. And then the police officer determined the person wasn't under the influence, that had nothing to do with the case. And that's not something that should come in just because it was said in answer to a question that the police officer asked. It sort of means that the public then, in terms of public policy, has to think, okay, I shouldn't answer this question to the police officer because it might be used against me, even if it's, you know, if it's highly prejudicial to me or the rules of evidence might exclude it. And our position was the rules of evidence would exclude that statement. Moving on to the issue of the helmet use, this actually came up because the plaintiff filed a motion in limine to prevent any discussion of helmet use at trial. I didn't affirmatively assert that. And in response, my position was that it was a secondary assumption of the risk issue because this was a plaintiff who had been on a prior motorcycle in an accident where he had a serious head injury, was in a coma, missed a lot of time from work, and knew that he was at a greater risk for another head injury without a helmet while riding a motorcycle.
Aren't juries routinely told that every driver has the right to assume that other drivers are going to obey the rules of the road?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't this create a different rule? Isn't this leading to every motorcyclist must assume that they're going to be injured?
Well, this didn't have anything to do with liability, and the jury was only told that it dealt with negligence. The plaintiff could have asked for a stronger curative instruction to say you cannot consider this on the issue of negligence. We never argued to the jury that the motorcycle helmet use or lack thereof had anything to do with the accident. So technically, the jury never even got to that issue because the jury didn't get to damages in this case. They only dealt with the issue of whether Michelle Kasson was negligent. They did not even get to whether Mr. McKinley was negligent. So if they didn't get to that, then it makes it something that's probably a moot point. At the same time, it only dealt with his injuries. Dr. Townsend did testify that he was at higher risk of having a head injury and a worse head injury as a result. I'm not sure exactly what he said. He did say that he was at a higher risk because of the prior head injury. So we never used it at all during the trial to talk about liability. It wasn't a huge part of the case, but it did come out because of the ruling the judge made.
Well, was the instruction given to the jury on the issue of helmet use worded in a way that could have confused the jury, that has made it difficult or impossible for the jury to parse out whether that evidence was relevant to liability or damages?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It was not given in the area of liability instructions. It was given after we were done with that, once damages were discussed, and it was then addressed as part of the damage instructions. Plaintiff could have asked for an instruction during the course of the trial to say to the jury, you cannot take this into account as to the liability in the case. This can only be used in dealing with the damage. Plaintiff didn't ask for that type of an instruction during the trial.
You heard the question that I asked your colleague. What is the analysis that the trial judge used for allowing the helmet or the lack of helmet use to be a part of the case, whether it affected negligence or whether it was limited to damages notwithstanding? What was the rationale for her conclusion that it was admissible at all?
Your Honor, I don't recall that she gave us a specific rationale. What I find often in trial is that a judge will listen to the arguments and either say, I'm going to let it in, I'm not, it's objected, I mean, it's sustained or it's overruled. So it was my belief that she accepted the arguments that had been set forth in the motion response provided by the defendant in giving her opinion. But she did not give us any specific legal analysis when she gave her decision.
Did she at all explain why the instruction as given would prevent the jury from being, as Justice Jacobs put it, confused because they would conflate, well, you weren't wearing a helmet, no wonder you were injured, it's your fault more than it's the defendant's fault, so we're not going to find the defendant negligent at all. Is there any danger of the jury being confused by this conflation?
Well, the way it was put in the jury instructions, no.
I know the placement in the jury instruction.
Right.
What about the instruction?
It said, the only thing the instruction said, if you believe that he assumed the risk in not wearing a helmet, you may take that into account in considering his allegations or the severity of his damage, something along those lines. So it did not say you can consider whether the accident would have happened. It just said if you think that was an issue and that he assumed the risk, you can take it into account as to damages. So it was very specific to that, and it clearly did not deal with any area of negligence.
Well, that would have been, I guess, immediately obvious to a lawyer, but is the wording such that it wouldn't be immediately obvious to a layperson? That's question one.
Since it specifically said you can take it into account as to damages, and that's all it said, it was telling the jury that's what you have to consider. And if they were confused, they do get a copy of the jury instructions. And I happen to be a lawyer who actually was a juror once and listened to the jury instructions, and it's a different experience, but they actually make more sense than I thought they would when I was sitting in the jury. But my position doesn't have anything to do with this.
Well, educate me on the record. Did this issue come up in a prayer conference, or did it come up in open court?
It came up in a motion in limine filed by the plaintiff before trial came out. And at the pretrial conference, the judge ruled that I could ask about the fact that he wasn't wearing a helmet on the issue of damages, and I could question his doctor about that. When we had the prayer conference, we looked at the assumption of risk. Prayer agreed it did not apply in this case and that it could only be applicable on the secondary assumption of the risk. So we put in a special secondary assumption of the risk prayer that dealt only with damages and said it only dealt with damages.
And all of that was on the record?
As far as I know, yes, Your Honor. Is there anything else the court would like me to address at this time?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor, and all of Your Honors.
The only thing I'd like to address is there was a comment made about the plaintiff did not have an expert who would have testified or would have been able to testify that the defendant's use or non-use of medication somehow contributed to the accident. The problem is we don't know what the medication was at the point that the defendant was using. At her discovery deposition, the defendant denied that she told the police officer that she takes prescription medication. She also denied that she, in fact, takes prescription medication for her fear of bridges. She only took it for a going on airplanes or when she's in a confined space. We tried to get the medical records so that we can find out what's correct.
Are you saying, I may be reading this the wrong way, that there was no need for expert testimony because the only use, the only purpose of the evidence you were trying to get in was to impeach her with an inconsistent statement that she made to the police?
Well, I think there were two reasons. One is...
I mean, that's distinguished from affirmatively trying to prove as part of your case that she was on prescription medication.
I think there were both. I think that one was to impeach her credibility, but also we didn't know whether she was taking medication, what type, whether it was for fear of bridges, to even get an expert to take a look at that and to say whether or not the use or non-use of the medication at the time of the accident would have had an effect. Would have caused the accident, would have caused her abruptly stop her vehicle, like she told the police officer.
I'm not sure I understand. Did the policeman's deposition, was it taken before trial?
Yes, it was.
So you knew before trial that the police were told by?
Correct. We knew the police officer had he testified in his discovery deposition that, yeah, that he, that of what the defendant had told him regarding the use
of the... So if there were a need for expert testimony, you certainly had an opportunity to develop it.
Well, I don't think without an expert knowing what type of medication it was, what the dosage was, I don't think an expert could have said, well, because she didn't take, we don't even know what the medication is, or that it would have had an effect on the cause of this accident. If we had the... If we were able to determine, okay, she takes this particular medication.
Let's back up for a minute.
Sure.
If all you're trying to do is to show that this defendant is not credible because she made two inconsistent statements And the one that you want to get into the record happens to deal with prescription medication.
Correct.
I gather your position would be you don't need an expert for that.
Correct.
Because all you're showing is that she testified inconsistently.
Yeah.
But if you're going to, if your purpose is also to show some other fact that requires establishing that she was on prescription medication, that might require expert testimony. Is that correct?
Correct.
And
I'm a little bit confused here. You recognized apparently that the issue of what medication she was taking and for what purposes could impact the trial, right?
Yes.
But you were denied the opportunity to get any medical records or information about her medications.
Correct. So therefore, we couldn't present that to an expert to even give us an opinion as to whether that would or wouldn't have any effect on her cause or her anxiety related to the accident.
Well, one last question.
Sure.
If your side was attempting to show that the defendant was on prescription medication for purposes other than impeachment, what were you trying to show, or what would you have shown had you had access to the records and time to get an expert?
We would have been able to find out what medication that she was taking, what the dosage was.
To prove what?
Pardon me?
To prove what?
Well, because we can show that to an expert for an expert to take a look at that.
And opine about what?
About whether that would have an effect on her anxiety level and would have been part of the cause for the accident.
For the purpose of resolving whether it was more likely than not that she stopped suddenly or abruptly as opposed to slowing down and pulling to the side of the road, that's what you told us.
Correct. Right? Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.
Aye.